morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jennifer.
Well, before we begin, you can go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Jennifer Winkler on behalf of Christopher Sefton, and Mr. Kumaro is here on behalf of Ms. Lloyd. And would you like to know times?
Well, I know times, which is what I was going to take up.
Okay.
You each filed briefs on behalf of your clients. You each raise very different issues, and there was a request for additional time. The way we have addressed this and discussed addressing it is, I know this was co-defendants, I know it was one trial, but we will, you'll have 10 minutes.
Okay.
And the state can respond to your argument.
Okay.
So we're treating them separately.
Okay.
Now, I do know that you each filed notices that you join in each other's arguments, but there's nothing in the briefs that says anything to that nature. So we would be interested in your response to our approach, which is to file two different opinions but drop into a footnote that you have each filed notices adopting the other's arguments.
I can't think of a problem with that, Your Honor.
Okay. So with that, we're going to treat these separately. I know that we have similar facts.
Can we still sit together, though?
You can.
Thank you.
And you can talk, too.
Okay.
All right. So with all of that, you'll have 10 minutes, and if you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal, you may.
All right. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I know how much time Mr. Kumaro would like, but I'll let him tell you.
Okay.
He would like 5 minutes. So I'm here to talk about two issues today, although the brief raises more issues than that. Jury unanimity on the assault charge, assault of a child, and then the opinion on guilt or the veracity of Mr. Sefton.
So that's Kaiser.
Kaiser.
And that's Demery.
And Demery.
All
right. That's right. So Kaiser is distinguishable. As I think I put it in the reply brief, I think Kaiser is the exception. We are asking that this court apply the general rule, which is that where there is no unanimity instruction in a multiple acts case, and make no mistake, this is a multiple acts case. The state's closing argument very clearly recognized three possible primary assaults, the assault causing substantial bodily harm. And the way that the statute reads is, commits the crime of assault in the first degree against the child or intentionally assaults the child, sorry, that's irrelevant, recklessly inflicts great bodily harm or causes substantial bodily harm, and that's where we are, and the person has previously engaged in a pattern or practice of either assaulting the child, and then it goes on with the ancillary type assaults.
So the question here has to do with the pattern and practice.
This has to do with substantial bodily harm. And this is
I know that, but the way the crime is defined is
right.
Substantially bodily harm or pattern in practice.
Substantial bodily harm, and then we have this pattern or practice. So there needs to be a primary assault, and then to elevate that to first degree, there needs to be something in the background or something else going on. But
otherwise known as a pattern in practice?
Right. But there still needs to be a substantial bodily harm producing assault. And that puts this in the category of other cases addressing substantial or assaults. And I think the closest case is not actually Kaiser, despite the identity of crime, but the Petridge case, which involves the same victim, indeed, but different assaults. And so we have different times and places. And if you look at there was no election here. I think the actually most helpful to our case is the state's closing argument, where the prosecutor is talking about the three possible assaults, which are the ear, the hands, and the mouth. And those all occurred at different times, different places, different defenses. Now, in the Kaiser case, we have an infant who's 3 months old, and we have a situation where the assault must have occurred at a very over a very short period. There's no way to distinguish. There's no difference in defenses. Here, we have a very different situation. I think there's different defenses to the mouth injury, to the ear bruising, and the swollen hands. I think the weakest is the swollen hands, because we have Dr. Wiester saying that she doesn't even know what this is, and there's a lot of statement this could just be dermatitis, probably serious dermatitis, but very concerning, yes, and possibly the product of malnutrition. Is that an assault? No, that's not an assault under the common law definition. So,
and so now on to Demery and the interview.
Right. Now, Demery, as we know, is one of those cases where the four judges who get to say their piece first, or the four justices who get to say their piece first, that's not the actual holding of the case. And I filed on Friday a statement of additional authorities, which is an unpublished decision, but I filed that because on Friday, because that's when we prepare for oral arguments, but also because I think that case brings out something important, which is that These types of statements.
What is the case?
The case is West, okay. The West case. And that came out, I think, last Monday.
Okay.
And I recognize it's unpublished, but I think it says something very important in Demery and the cases like Notaro and Smiley that cite Demery, which is that these kind of statements in interrogation are perhaps useful, and I take issue with citing the first portion of Demery, but as I stated, they're perhaps useful to explain a change of story. We've got an accused person saying one thing, and then all of a sudden, later in the interrogation, they're saying something different. We don't have that here. We don't have anything close to that here. We do have inconsistent statements.
Well, you have you have Ms. Lloyd and you have Mr. Sefton in different rooms.
Well, yeah.
So as I understand it, the detectives are talking to one individual and then going back and talking to the other individual and saying, well, this is what was said. What's your response to that? What's your version? Why did that person say that?
Right, with very varying degrees of accuracy. But I think the state would have been entitled to point out the inaccuracies and the inconsistencies, but they don't change their story. This goes back to the idea of...
They don't. I mean, you know, so I kind of wondered why this wasn't harmless error. I mean, so...
Well, because...
Mr. Sefton says over and over again, I don't know why Ms. Lloyd's saying that. I don't know why she's coming up with this version. And so he never admits anything.
Right, but we have police officers, detectives, upstanding detectives, in comparison to Mr. Sefton, who is not a conventional thinker or believer, clearly, from his 300-page, several-hour interview. We have these upstanding detectives saying, you're withholding food. And withholding is one of the elements of criminal mistreatment. He's saying, this isn't to make sure he's getting proper nutrition. This is a form of discipline. And that's an opinion on guilt. And that's
But the objection's not made until after this is played. And so, you know, if the objection had been made beforehand, the transcript could have been redacted, the video could have been redacted.
That's right. And
what
that's,
do we do with that?
I believe it was ineffective assistance, which does not put me in the standard of review that I would ideally want for my client. I do believe the error was preserved, because I do believe that under the Lindsay case and under the Jimmy James Hamilton case, this would have been futile. It was timely under Lindsay, although there was no motion for new trial or for mistrial. But I believe further objection would have been futile. And he realized that this was really bad, and he did object. And unfortunately, the tide had moved along, and he knew he wasn't going to get this four-hour redaction hearing, which was what was needed in this case, because this is really bad.
Why isn't a limiting instruction enough? Why shouldn't he just have asked for that at that point? To say, what the officers say to these people in interviews is not testimony by the officers in this court, and should not be considered an opinion or testimony.
That would have maybe done it. It might have rung the bell. This court would probably say that it was tactical to not ring the bell. I disagree.
Well, you can respond.
All right.
In 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm James Wispin, appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Washington. I'll start with the recorded issue, just because we can go from one to the next views on that. Our primary argument there, our first argument there, was that that this claim shouldn't be reviewed because it wasn't preserved. And I think I put in my brief, this claim wasn't raised until 18th day of trial, after 9 days of witness testimony from 37 different witnesses, and when only 30 minutes of 360 minutes of recordings had already been played. Sorry, when only 30 minutes remained of about 6 hours of recorded statements.
So that we're clear, all the witnesses were called. The last piece of evidence the state introduced was the videotaped interview.
I can't remember if it was dead last, but it was after 37 other witnesses had already testified.
And so the jury watched 6 hours?
Almost.
I mean, never mind the 30 minutes, but the jury watched the entire 6 hours?
The jury had watched the majority of the recorded interviews before the objection was made. And
But that was 6 hours?
There was approximately 6 hours.
So the jury watched all 6 hours?
I can't remember if the jury watched the entire thing. The jury watched hours of testimony.
Okay.
Because I don't think that these were redacted in any way. But that's exactly the problem. I mean, these could have easily been redacted in any number of ways to extract the most egregious statements that defense counsel wanted to complain about. But defense counsel didn't even ask the judge to strike this testimony or to redact portions of it after it had been played. And the reason that he didn't, the reason that Sefton didn't, the reason that Lloyd also didn't, remember, Lloyd's lawyer made absolutely no objection whatsoever to this testimony, because both of them wanted those recordings to be in front of the jury. And if you look at their closing arguments, they urged the jury to go and watch the recorded interview to judge these people by their demeanor both in the interviews and their demeanor while testifying at trial. They wanted the jury to compare the statements that the defendants had made to the detectives with the statements they made in court, because they were largely consistent. And so the interviews gave each side something in this case. It wasn't ideal. There were aspects of the interviews that we were able to exploit. There were aspects of the interviews that obviously worked to our advantage. But remember, at the beginning, we hadn't even intended to admit these recordings. We did so only once both defense counsel said in opening statement that they were going to, that their clients were going to testify. And the record reflects that the prosecutor had a conversation with the defense attorneys where it was agreed that we would just go ahead and play them in our case in chief instead of at the end of the trial. So I think all these indicators suggest that both defense counsel wanted these tapes to be in trial, it played at the trial. Now, I don't.
Now, why would the interviews be admissible simply because the defense attorneys say their clients are going to testify?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be admissible for only that reason. My point is only that the defense counsel anticipated these were coming in and saw benefit to that. Now, the issue of their...
This goes to the ineffective assistance, then.
That's right. It goes to the ineffective assistance problem, but it also goes to the overall strategic usefulness of this evidence to the defense, and why they waited until the last minute to make what was, quite frankly, a pro forma objection. It takes a very small portion of the record. Counsel never even makes a motion to strike. It's almost as if somebody said to him, hey, you know, you should probably be objecting to the fact that the officers are making these statements in the closing argument. I'm sorry, in the interrogation. But it certainly doesn't seem to have figured that prominently in their strategy. In fact, it would be contrary to their strategy to remove those things. Could there have been some redaction? Of course there could have been. But I don't think under these circumstances you are anywhere near the situation that you saw in Montgomery, where the Supreme Court was willing to review a claim like this without objection. In Montgomery, remember, that was the detectives testifying in the possession with intent case, where the multiple detectives in court offered direct testimony suggesting that they believed that these people had intended to manufacture methamphetamine, I believe it was. The court was willing to review that for the first time on appeal. That's a very different sort of situation than you have here. Yes, Demery and Montgomery both, under our existing law, say that it's an opinion on credibility and an opinion on the ultimate issue. But there's a huge difference in character, and there's a huge difference, too, between an opinion that is offered during or a statement that is made during the interrogation. So I don't think that this court
well,
must
review
that.
Well, but that was the dispute between the justices and Demery. So
that was one of the disputes. You're right.
So is factually, is this case like Demery?
This case is like Demery in some respects, except in Demery there was an objection and a request to redact that was made at trial. And that's the point that I'm trying to make now. So in Demery there was an objection. In Montgomery there wasn't. In Montgomery they were willing to review it for the first time on appeal because it was so direct a comment from the witness in court. I don't think that's the same here. When you don't have the same kind of direct comment, I don't think the court has an obligation to review it for the first time on review, especially where the defense used it very strategically. You know, think about, I mean, it puts the trial court in an impossible position. Now they get the advantage of the feeble objection that was made late in trial, and they get the advantage in front of the jury to use that evidence as they see fit. I mean, that's exactly what the court warned against many years ago in Swan. You know, you can't just sit on your objection until late in the game, then switch horses, and then try and, you know, and gamble that the jury's going to use the evidence in your favor, and if they don't, well, we've got now an issue in your back pocket for appeal.
Now turning to Kaiser.
Well, in Kaiser, of course, we're in somewhat a similar position because there was absolutely no objection made to this instruction. The judge asked the lawyers at the end of the case whether it was satisfied with the instructions that had been given and whether there were anything else that any other instruction that the parties wanted submitted, and neither counsel said that they wanted a different instruction or a Petrich instruction. I realize that we're probably dead in the water on that and that they can raise that claim for the first time on
appeal.
Yes,
they can.
But what it goes to a slightly different issue, which is, you know, could the prosecutor have elected if she wanted to? Probably. But what Kaiser says is, and
so why isn't this a Petrich problem?
And what Kaiser says, and this is in the Whippet comments and everything, is it is not necessary for all jurors to agree on what act was the principal assault. Okay? So that is about as clear a statement as you could make that in the context of an assault of a child case, you don't need unanimity in the usual Petrich sense. Now, I would say that as to this crime, Kaiser states the general rule. And you have to have some unusual set of circumstances to justify a departure from that as to this particular crime. But if we were required to meet the usual Petrich test, I think that you could characterize this situation as a continuing course. And like counsel, I'll go back to Petrich. In Petrich, they said it wasn't a continuing course, but the charge period there was a year and 9 months. The events in the charging period here was about 5.5-6 months, but the relevant three acts that counsel was talking about, the ear, the mouth, and the burned hands, those occurred within approximately a 22-day period from about February 26th of 14 until about March 20th when the child was finally removed at school and taken from the parents' custody. Those acts occurred in that window of time. So that's a much more narrow window of time than either the whole charging period or much more narrow than you had in Petrich. In Kaiser, it was an even smaller period. I don't remember exactly how small it was, but it was a smaller period of time, and you had a cluster of injuries with x-rays, et cetera. And what this court said in that case was that's a continuing course because it's so small. It's true that here that the events occurred on different dates. But what I would suggest is what you have here is the commonality is these the net was tightening on these people is what it comes down to. And what had been a pattern of low-level abuse and then, of course, very severe starvation escalated in these last 20 days or so. And you see then these more serious events, which appear designed to make this kid be quiet, because things were starting to unravel for the parents at the school and with CPS. And that's what I think draws them together, if we have to fit it under the usual rubric. But I don't think you do under Kaiser. I'll be back in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll jump back to the opinion on guilt. We believe that the error was preserved. The worst opinions on guilt occurs at the last part of Sefton's interview, so that is when the objection would occur. Now, we do also feel that the law supports that this was ineffective assistance. Now, what the court suggested here, the court said, why don't you handle this on cross-examination? But as we've argued, cross-examination only made it worse. It appears that the detective really did believe that Mr. Sefton was guilty. There was some inept cross-examination. That further goes to the ineffectiveness claim. This case isn't like Demery and the other cases in the sense that in those cases, there's comments like, oh, that doesn't make sense to me. There's a lot of that in this case, and there's a lot worse in this case. We're not objecting to the, oh, that doesn't make sense to me. I mean, this 300 pages, the 6 hours is full of things like that, but we also have things like Ms. Lloyd can't deny the charges. They refer to neglect, which was brought out in the state's briefing. That, oh, it's neglect, but they keep calling the police officers keep calling it serious felony neglect, which sounds an awful lot like criminal mistreatment. They even say that Sefton is under arrest for felony neglect, and then the detective Feeney says, Lloyd made some comments. It is quite clear that I believe the food issue, the chopping up in a blender, was not to make sure he had adequate food, but it's a form of discipline, which is withholding, which is the heart of the charge. Feeney then says that his story, that Mr. Sefton's story, that he's attempting to provide proper nutrition is not believable, that Lloyd lied because she knew what Mr. Sefton did was wrong. Then at the very end, this is one of the last things the jury is hearing, Feeney says Sefton was using blended meals as a form of discipline or even torture, and it got in over his head. And again, that goes back to the idea that discipline is withholding food. It's not for nutrition. It's not torture, it's mistreatment, because withholding is at the heart of that charge. So I'm going to move on to Kaiser real briefly. Kaiser, I think the language in Kaiser that the state would like to be the controlling rule is really at heart a harmlessness analysis. It's kind of shorthand. It's not saying that this is the general rule, or if it is, I don't think it's meaning to say that. It's a saying that this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because we really can't distinguish and you can't argue any differently. You don't have a different defense on any of these. Therefore, it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But in this case, this is a far different situation, and I don't think that...
Was there a different defense on those three incidents that you pointed to?
Oh, yes, there was. There was, for example, the medical evidence on the hands. Mr. Sefton says, there's no way I could have reached back and hit him in the mouth. The car layout doesn't work for that. Then with the ear thing, there's several different stories about what happened. So each is very different. It's not a continuing course of conduct under any stretch of the imagination.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.